thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight Black Voices. I'm Joanna Hernandez, filling in for Brandis Freeman, who has the evening off. Here's what we're looking at.
In order to repair something, you have to acknowledge that something is broken.
Southside residents take part in a study about reparations. We discuss the major takeaways.
They deserve more than just a passing glance in history.
An effort to document Illinois connections with the Underground Railroad. A new opera exploring a black family's grief and journey towards healing. And we visit a South Suburban brew pub that serves as a tribute to the founder's late son. And now to some of today's top stories. Welcome back. That was a message from the Oval Office today as President Joe Biden sat down with President-elect Donald Trump at the White House. The nearly two-hour meeting was part of the transition process, a formality that Trump did not extend to Biden in 2020. Biden called for a peaceful transition of power, while Trump acknowledged that politics can be tough and in many cases, quote, not a very nice world. Trump is set to be sworn in on January 20th. And nurses at the University of Illinois Hospital are striking once again. This morning, hundreds of nurses from the Illinois Nurses Association walked off the job and joined the picket line amid ongoing contract negotiations that have lasted several months. According to the association, the nurses have been working without a contract since the summer. They are demanding improved security, better staffing, and higher wages. In a statement, UI Health addressed the situation, stating that the majority of UI Health nurses are currently paid 90% more than other nurses in the Chicagoland area. Quote, when it comes to the top issue that matter to our UI Health nurses, compensation and safety and security, the university has made substantive offers that would lead to meaningful benefits. The strike is scheduled to continue through next Tuesday. And the Chicago Transit Authority Board is approving a $2 billion operating budget for 2025. It's the final year the transit agency can rely on federal stimulus money to plug a budget gap. That COVID relief money will run out in early 2026. State lawmakers are currently debating how to deal with the fiscal cliff facing Chicago area transit agencies and what reforms to demand in exchange. The board also approved the CTA's capital improvement plan for the next several years, including the massive Red Line extension to 130th Street. CTA President Dorval Carter anticipates federal funding for the project will be secured before the Biden administration concludes its term. We have more on this story on our website. And the food delivery company Grubhub will soon have new owners. Just Eat Takeaway announced today that it is selling the Chicago-based business for $650 million to a New York company called Wonder Group, which is led by former Walmart executive Mark Lohr. Just Eat purchased Grubhub back in 2020 during the COVID-19 pandemic for more than $7 billion. The transaction is expected to be completed in the first quarter of 2025. And up next, Brandis Freeman and takeaways from a local reparation study in a conversation recorded earlier.
Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, is made possible in part by the support of these donors.
The country's war on drugs, launched in the 1970s, was intended to reduce illegal drug use. But instead, it led to decades of criminalization and incarceration for millions of people and even increased levels of violence. That so-called war is one reason some Southside residents say they could be owed a form of reparations. It's laid out in a recent report from the Chicago Urban League. And joining us now is Chicago Urban League CEO Karen Freeman Wilson. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So the study, it focuses on 10 Southside community areas that folks can see on the screen, but I will read them out. Douglas, Inglewood, Fuller Park, Grand Boulevard, Greater Grand Crossing, Oakland, South Shore, Washington Park, West Inglewood, and Woodlawn. Tell us about these communities and why they are the focus of this report.
Well, the reason that the report focused on those communities, Brandis, is that it was a part of the R3 appropriation from the state of Illinois, which meant that it was only good for certain areas or it could only be used in certain areas.
And but R3 standing for?
Restore, reinvest, and recommit.
It's
the cannabis dollars. And so while we focus on those areas, the report is not only relevant to those areas, because we think that there are facts and aspects of the report that we can extrapolate for other areas of the South and West Sides as well.
So in the report, or through the research, what did you learn about how residents view reparations?
Well, we went into the report thinking this is something that could be done as a group or a community effort. And the main thing that residents said was that reparations are for individuals. You know, and I think when we went into the report, we were thinking we want to make it somewhat more acceptable and easier to pass either at the state, federal level, at the local level. But the reality is that people feel that their harm has impacted them as individuals, it has impacted their families, and that's true, has impacted us. And so to the extent that the harm has been individually, we believe, and the report tells us that the repair should be towards individuals as well.
A lot of people might look at this project and think, you know, Chicago's a northern city. It does not have the same history of slavery and to some extent Jim Crow as in a lot of southern states. But what do folks need to know about why black Chicagoans should also be acknowledged in the fight for reparations?
So what we understand about Chicago is that the banks in Chicago benefited from slavery. Many of the institutions in terms of retail institutions that were the basis for building Chicago benefited from slavery. And so it's not a North-South thing. This entire country was built on the backs of slaves. And even though you have northern cities, you can trace the benefit of slavery as far north as Maine.
So black Americans, you know, you've named a couple of things already. We can look back over the decades, over the centuries, and find multiple reasons that they think, you know, reparations, for which reparations could be made. Slavery, obviously, Jim Crow laws, redlining and housing discrimination. Why the war on drugs?
The war on drugs because it is simply an extension of the other aspects of our lives, Reconstruction, lynching, Jim Crow laws, redlining, the contracts, the housing, real estate contracts. And what we saw was when the war on drugs was fought, it was, you know, veiled as something that was meant to help people, but ultimately the inequities inherent in enforcing that war and in waging that war had a disparate impact in the black community.
Among the policy recommendations from the report are guaranteed income programming, a public acknowledgement and apology, integration of truth and reconciliation work. That just names a few, but why are some of these important and how would some of them work?
Well, these are important because in order to repair something, you have to acknowledge that something is broken. And to say that this war had a terrible impact on the community, and not just on those who were incarcerated because they were arrested, but because of the way that drugs left the community in terms of the appearance of Southside neighborhoods. And so you have that. And then you have the fact that when you try to come together, when you try to correct something, if you acknowledge that there is something wrong, then there may be more resolve on the part of those who benefited from that wrong and those who may have perpetrated that wrong. If there's a resolve on their part, then you have a more likely chance of having it corrected.
Study also proposes adding lessons on civil rights abuses and the war on drugs to the Chicago Public Schools and City Colleges curricula. Why do you think that's necessary?
Well, because it's important. I think it's necessary so that people will understand that the violence that we see, the challenges that we see, the blight that we see in our communities, it just didn't happen. It didn't happen because people are more violent or more prone to do certain things. It happened because of a history of violence from the slave codes, a history of violence from the war on drugs, a history of really disinvesting in our communities and using drugs as an excuse.
Karen, what's next? How do you turn this report into action steps, into change?
Well, we're able to sew into work that's already been being done. Cam Howard, who's almost the father of reparations, has come up with a set of action steps that we would welcome people to take a look at and consider. Things like supporting H.R. 40, which is the federal resolution to create a reparations commission. We also know that the city of Chicago has begun work on creating a task force so that we can study this issue and consider it. The universal basic income work that's being done both in the city and the county are ways that we can also address this. All of those are important, and the Urban League, we consider ourselves conveners, or at least helping people to understand that there are concerted efforts that we can take together to get this done.
So it sounds like you think there's already some infrastructure there, just needs more to be done, of course. Karen Freeman Wilson, CEO of the Chicago Urban League, thank you so much for joining us. Good to see you.
Thank you, Brandis. It's always great to be here.
And we're back with more right after this.
A state task force is releasing its findings this week on the important role Illinois played in the history of the Underground Railroad. The group estimates as many as 7,000 people traveled through Illinois to escape slavery. Members of the task force say there could be at least 200 sites in Illinois that are part of that history and are now proposing a commission to organize the sites, research them, and work to preserve the history.
Across the country, some are tirelessly trying to prevent people from learning about our country's history of racism, as well as fearless preservation of black Americans who fought to escape slavery through the Underground Railroad. That's why today I'm more proud than ever that Illinois' commitment to the shining light on our past, both good and bad parts, and to celebrate our ancestors' commitment to fighting justice and freedom.
Illinois' role in the Underground Railroad is not well known or marked. There may be more than 200 sites that can be identified with the journeys of freedom seekers and the work of the Underground Railroad in Illinois. Most of these have not been fully identified, and only relatively small numbers have been deeply researched.
Many in Illinois believe we need to travel to the East Coast to visit locations on the Underground Railroad, unaware of the enormous activity that took place in their own backyards here in Illinois. This talks about the story of these countless unknown, unrecognized, underappreciated individuals that offered up their home to complete strangers at great risk to themselves. And then those individuals as well that were brave enough to make this treacherous run to freedom with the hope and dream that someday their lives would be better. Those stories need to be shared.
There's an absolutely remarkable set of sites, from historic houses to identified trails to storehouses, all kinds of places where various people have found the evidence that that's where freedom seekers found some kind of assistance. And the power of the commission is to enable us to connect all those dots, put all those places together.
And task force members say they are unsure about what a network of sites would look like, but that it could open tourism and education opportunities while some of the sites remain on private property. And a new production at the Lyric Opera follows a black family grappling with grief after they lose their son to police violence, all while the father serves as a police officer. The opera is called Blue, and the characters are all nameless and just referred to as father, mother, and son. The production explores injustice and finding healing through faith and community. Here from the cast are Kenneth Kellogg, who plays a character known as Father, and Zoe Reams, a Chicago native who plays the mother character. Thank you both for joining us. I want to start off, Zoe. The show is incredibly unique because we don't often see Black focused opera in that often. How do you think the medium of opera helps shape the story?
I think that being something on stage, it elevates what you can talk about and it elevates a story to the point where maybe you're able to remove yourself a little bit from it, but at the same time you're able to talk about things that you might not bring up in passing with someone or on the street or at a dinner table. It might be awkward, it might be too uncomfortable, it might be too difficult. And I think stage in general, especially opera, which is a medium that has pretty much everything. You have music, you have singing, you have acting, stage directing, lights, camera, well, not so much camera, but everything except amplification, which I think also gives a natural connection to the human voice. I think it's a perfect way to amplify those stories and have more difficult conversations like this show does.
And what about you, Keith? What are your thoughts?
Kenneth. And I mean, I think the arts is that space to have these conversations, you know. And in opera, it's heightened emotion. You're living emotions at their highest level when you come to the opera. And these are often stories you don't get to hear about. And they're stories that are put to the side. So to put this story on the stage with the ability to enhance the emotion and express and display the emotions of the community that normally don't get heard is really powerful in this piece, I think.
And talking about that, you play the father who's also a police officer.
Yes.
Now, being a Black cop is an identity that comes with a lot of baggage, given, you know, what people's relationship with the criminal justice system is. How difficult was it to showcase that duality for you?
It was difficult in the sense that I didn't know what it meant to be a police officer. I didn't know how it felt, you know, or why someone who looked like me would choose to be a police officer. Being a father, I knew. I could easily dive into that. But Tazewell, the director, had the brilliant idea of me meeting with an actual police officer who was Black. His name was Frank, and he consulted, you know, Tazewell in developing the piece. So I asked Frank, it's like, why? As a Black man, why choose to be a police officer? And his answer had nothing to do with division. And it was all about humanity and wanting to help and better his community. And everything else came after that. But his intentions were pure, and it was to help and to help his community and his neighborhood be better.
So you've got a different perspective.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I found my way in through that. I mean, I don't imagine, or I imagined, you know, being a police officer came with a certain level of knowing and want. It didn't come with the negativity. I mean, I don't think that's a choice anyone would make going into policing. And not being a police officer, I couldn't really even dive into that. But getting to know a Black police officer personally and understand his personal story, I was able to find the humanity in the choice.
That's really interesting. And Zoe, there's a scene in the show where the mother tells a group of women what her husband does. Hey. Let's watch that.
You married a cop. You married a cop. You married a cop.
And so, in putting yourself in those shoes, in the wife's shoes, why do you think that that evoked that kind of response from this group of women?
Yeah, I mean, I think, unfortunately, our community knows too well about the horrors of what can happen to a community and to a family when faced with something like what you might think is, you know, just being pulled over or, you know, just being stopped for something could end terribly. We've seen it all too many times. So I think in that moment, it's just really hard for the friends to grasp why she would put herself willingly in that situation. The next part after that, though, is this beautiful aria that the mother sings about how she's loved by this man. And I think that is super important, too, the dichotomy of it's not perfect, but I know this man loves me. And for Black love to be on stage, I think is so beautiful. It is, you know, it's hard to address a lot of the things that happen in our community because they are so heavy. But I love that dichotomy of, I'm with this man because I love him and he loves me truly, deeply, unconditionally.
That is beautiful to see.
Yeah.
It explores many different concepts and things that people go through.
Exactly.
And when we see the son in opposition with the father, yeah, arguing about how to properly present yourself, what are those two characters meant to tell us about, you know, how they come across?
Yeah, I think that division between the father and the son, I think it's generational. The father comes from a generation of, you know, follow the law, do things in the correct way, or whatever the correct way is, and you'll be safe in the world. And it's been proven, I mean, we see that doing the right thing isn't always the answer. And the son is from the generation of, you know, I have to do something and say something for the system to change. And if I don't do it, then things won't change. So I think there is that butting of heads of generations. And in that scene, it's a beautiful
yeah,
clash.
And it
of
seems like they're
powers,
like living two different experiences.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we are. Generationally, we are. I mean, the first thing you often hear when, you know, a black body has been killed is, why didn't they do something? Like, it's justification for their murder or them being taken. And no matter what you do, losing your life should not be the result.
Zoe, you're a Chicago native.
Yes.
You know, what does it mean to, you know, act in your hometown, to be part
everything
of this show?
Yeah, we got like 50 people coming.
Well, that's great.
But I think it's so important that, you know, I'm just happy that people are going to be able to see this, people that look like us, people that look like the people that are on stage. It's just a really cool opportunity, and I hope for more opportunities like that to come as often as they can. It's just going to be a special night for my friends, family, and community,
yeah,
to be in the audience.
That's really great. And Kenneth, I want to go to you, just piggybacking on what you said. Opera is something that many people think as an upper class of people, and Blue is telling a very contemporary story that's felt by all classes of people. How has Blue changed what's possible in opera?
Yeah, I think Blue is special in that. And one of the things you mentioned earlier was about, you know, the characters not having names. I think Blue tells a universal story of love and loss of a family. And this just happens to be a black family in Harlem. But those universal ideas of being in love and, you know, having a child and that joy and that beauty and that, and losing someone to tragedy, those are universal stories. But in specifically, we're talking about this black family. And it's a story that I think people really attach to, because of the awareness of what's going on in society. And it's on our in the front of our hearts and minds right now.
That's great. I can't wait to see it. The opening is this week, right?
Yes.
When is it? When does it run till?
November 16th is our opening, yeah, through December 1st is our closing show.
Well, thank you both, and good luck. Break a leg.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, a look at what's brewing in Homewood. But first, we check out the weather. Something new is brewing in the south suburbs. Homewood Brewing Company opened its doors last month after 3 years in the making. It's been a healing journey for founder Carmela Wallace, whose son Jared Hidgens, the rapper known as Juice WRLD, died of a drug overdose in 2019. Juice WRLD was known for his candid and introspective lyrics about his struggle with addiction and depression. His mother says the brew pub is a way to give back to the community while paying tribute to her son's memory.
I just wanted to find a way to give back to a community that was special to Jared and I. I just got the idea, and it just grew into this beautiful project and turned into something really special. And actually, in building this, it was a way for us to heal. You know, this project has been going on for so long, so the thought of serving and building something impactful in the community was just refreshing. He loved Homewood. When we were looking for a high school, we chose to move to Homewood because he wanted to go to Homewood Flossmoor High School. So he was very connected, and once he became famous, he still came back home to Homewood. We have a benefit beer in which 10% of net proceeds goes to my foundation, in which we pour out to help other people. We recently just gave a donation of $100,000 to various organizations for Mental Health Awareness Day to support programs that support mental health and substance dependency programs. Jared touched so many people through his music, and his message was for people not to suffer in silence and be alone. So I felt like I needed to continue his message and help those who were struggling and just find a way for them to get the help that they need.
Homewood Brewing Company is located on Dixie Highway near 183rd Street, and Wallace's organization, Live Free 999, supports programs addressing mental health and addiction. You can find more information on our website. And that's our show for this Wednesday night. Be sure to sign up for our free email newsletter, The Daily Chicagoan, at wttw.com/newsletter. You'll always find something there interesting. And stay connected with our reporters and what they're working on by following us on Instagram at WTTW Chicago. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. City Council members push back on the mayor's property tax hike proposal. In Chicago's Board of Education demands Acero keep its schools open or return public funds. Now, from all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Joanna Hernandez. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that is proud to recognize its 20 attorneys recognized in the 2025 edition of the Best Lawyers in America.